So last time we talked about an example to illustrate parallel computing that was an example involving a bunch of bricklayers building a brick wall. And in the analogy, we had a very long wall that we were going to build, and this is equivalent to having a very large set of data in a computer problem that we need to solve. And we solved it by having a number of bricklayers to each lay a section of the wall, and we talked about various ways to decompose the wall. So this time there's just a few more comments to make regarding this example. And the first is that when you think about decomposing the wall into various parts, then we might wonder if it's different for what the bricklayers do as if they were laying a wall all by themselves, or if they were laying a wall in parallel with a bunch of other people. Presumably they have to lay the bricks in a somewhat different fashion. And this is important consideration because in our analogy with computing, this is equivalent to thinking about, suppose we had a program that could solve the entire problem, suppose that it was a problem that had an array of data analogous to our long wall of bricks, and we wanted to think about breaking up the array into sections of data the same way we broke up the wall. And what program should we run on each section of the wall? Do we have to write a different program for each section of the wall? And essentially, we don't, because each subtask that is being performed on part of the wall, or that each bricklayer is doing on its part of the wall, is the same, essentially, in laying the bricks as a bricklayer would do on an entire wall. So on the entire wall, you would say first, lay down the first row of bricks from position 1 to position 100, say, and then lay down the second row of bricks from position 1 to position 100. But what would be different about the subtask, that is, what a bricklayer does is overlaying part of the wall, is that they will have different geometry. That is, their task will be to lay the first row of bricks from position, say, position 4 to position 8. And furthermore, in the original wall, when you got to the end, you had certain boundary tasks that you had to do to make the wall line up. And on the subparts, the boundary tasks that you might have to do might be just a little bit different. But essentially, we can write the same program and run the same program on each subtask as long as we put in some conditionals to deal with the cases that we have different boundary conditions, and also to use to have different variables to account for the fact that the geometry is a little different for the subparts. So that's essentially what I've described as the data parallel algorithm case, where you're going to do essentially the same algorithm on the different parts. Now let's consider another issue that arises in parallel computing that we can illustrate with our wall. And that is that sometimes we have what's called an irregular problem. That is, suppose that it wasn't laid out in a regular rectangular grid of bricks in our wall. Suppose that our wall had some parts that were higher than others. And the importance here is that when we think about the decomposition of the wall, is we no longer want to chop up the wall into equal pieces as far as the length of the wall. Because if we do, then some parts of the wall will have a smaller number of bricks than the other parts. And we're assuming that it takes the same amount of time to lay each brick, so that some bricklayers will have less work than others. And this will slow down the parallel task or slow down the task overall, because some bricklayers will have less to do and they'll have to wait for the bricklayers that have more to do. And in the computer analogy, this corresponds to the different processors having a load imbalance. That is, some processors would have more work than others. So of course the solution is that we want to carefully decompose the work according to an equal amount of work and not an equal area of the domain. And in the case of the brick wall, essentially we want each subtask to have the same number of bricks because they each take the same amount of time to lay. And then we will get a load balancing situation between the different processors or the different brick layers. Now suppose we had an even more irregular wall. That is, in our previous walls, we had bricks that took the same amount of work to lay. But suppose that on this wall, every once in a while, there was a large stone that we might think of as a gargoyle that is put into the wall. And it's shown here as something with a little face on it. And they wouldn't have to be the same size, and so it might not be the case anymore that it took the same amount of work to put in a gargoyle as it did to put in a bunch of bricks. So here we have an inhomogeneous problem. That is, the elements themselves take a different amount of work. And so this is an important analogy with parallel computing because it often happens. And in this case, it is often hard to predict ahead of time how to divide up the problem because it's hard to predict where these gargoyles will occur. That is, where these spots that either take more or less amount of work than the other spots. So this is where, in order to have an equal amount of work on each processor, we might have to do what's called a dynamic assignment of work. That is, start out with some assignment of work to processors, but if there is a load imbalance, do a reassignment of the brick layers to the processors so that we don't end up with some processors having less work than others. There's two more terms about parallel computing that we can learn and illustrate by using this example with the wall. And these terms are global parallelism versus local parallelism. I think I may have mentioned this briefly before. But in global parallelism, that's what happens at the application level. We're going to break up the domain of data that we're working on, decompose the problem. The amount of parallelism that we're going to get is proportional to the size of the problem. Usually that's very large because we have a large amount of data to work on. And the unit of parallelism is the computer processor, or the brick layer in the case of the wall. This is the kind of parallelism that's primarily under the control of the programmer, and it's the kind that the parallel algorithms that we're going to study will worry about. There's also, in some of the things we've talked about for hardware, local parallelism, and that is parallelism that can happen in local operations processing the basic entities. In the case of the wall, the basic entities are the bricks, and we might think about a brick layer having some parallelism because they have two hands. They can pick up a brick with one hand, lay mortar with another hand, and so on, do some of those subtasks in parallel. And this happens in the computer case at the instruction level. That is, you might be doing one operation at the same time as another inside the processor, or the processor might be fetching arguments for the next operation while it's completing the operation that it did before. So this is a limited amount of parallels, but it's still very important to happen on processors. And it explains the term local parallelism. Now, there's one more very important issue that we need to illustrate with the wall, which is up until now, we assumed that the bricklayers just had a number of bricks that they could lay, and we didn't worry about where the bricks came from. But actually, bricks have to be delivered to the bricklayers, and this is equivalent in the computer analogy to having I/O to deliver data from outside sources. So in parallel computing, you can see immediately from the case with the bricklayers that it's very inefficient if there's only one truck or only one I/O path to deliver bricks to all the different bricklayers, and it would be much more efficient if we had parallel I/O, that is, if we had a number of trucks that could deliver bricks to the bricklayers. So this is very important in getting high bandwidth for I/O to parallel computers, and it's important not only in scientific computing, but especially important in information-based computing using databases, doing transaction analysis, where there is a lot of information on disk that has to be delivered. So that's the end of our example using the wall as to illustrate various issues of parallel computing. Now we'd have a few slides just to briefly look at what this means in a real-world example. And the example is that of the atmospheric model. We want to simulate the atmospheric processes. There are equations that represent the various properties, such as those listed here on the slide, conservation of momentum, mass, and energy, the ideal gas law, and so on. And the atmosphere that we're trying to simulate can be represented as a volume. And this volume will be represented in a three-dimensional grid where we're going to represent some number of points in the x and y direction, in the horizontal plane, and in the vertical direction, in the z direction. So nx, ny, and nz represent the number of points in the two horizontal directions and the vertical direction, respectively. And they might have values similar to those you see here. Now, it turns out that the kind of computation that will happen on the quantities involved in the atmospheric model are that in the horizontal dimension, there will be atmospheric dynamics involving changes of pressure, velocity of the air, and so on. And these are typically solved by finite difference equations. In the vertical direction, there will be radiation and other physical effects to compute. So representing the continuous domain of real air molecules by this grid is known as discretization, or we discretize the domain by having the grid. So we're going to represent these continuous quantities by a sequence of points in each direction. So at each point, we'll have a set of variables to store the quantities involved, the velocities, temperature, pressure, and so on. And then we can think about how we're going to do the computation. When we do the finite differences with approximate derivatives, there are various formulations for the problem, but they almost all involve doing, if you were going to update a point in the domain at the yellow point in the middle there, you would use some number of neighbors in the to the left, right, and out and in directions represented in that diagram at the bottom. Then when you are going to update the point with the quantities that are represented in the vertical dimension, you would use as the values from those light pink elements represented in the diagram. So these give what's called the stencil, that is, for each point, like the yellow point, in order to update it, there is a pattern, a stencil, of other points that are needed to be used. Now that we've set up this domain of points that we're going to operate on as a set of arrays representing the quantities, in this case we have a three-dimensional problem. We can think about decomposing the domain in various dimensions. We could decompose the domain in a one-dimensional way by saying that each piece of the domain was a slice. In this case, it's shown as a vertical slice. Or we could take a two-dimensional decomposition by taking by each subpart of the domain being a column. Or in the third case, a three-dimensional decomposition would break up the domain into these little unit cubes representing the points in the array. So how would we know what was the best decomposition? We would have to consider the properties of the communication of the that involved in that computation. And this involves looking at the stencils that we identified earlier. If in the horizontal plane, the communication is going to take place between each point and its neighbors according to that stencil that we saw, the yellow point in the middle and the pink neighbors in the left, right, out, and in directions. In the vertical dimension, it turns out that we need to compute using neighbors directly up and down in a column, and also so that we need that amount of communication. And also there are point times in the computation where we need to compute, for example, sums over entire volumes of the array. This is a global communication where we need to collect the number of elements from the entire array and sum them up. So we also talked last time about the process of thinking of parallel computing. We break up the problem, the data, into and think about the task that would be done on each piece of data. And then we look at the communication patterns. And then we may do this part that we called agglomeration, which is making up larger tasks in order to reduce communication. And it turns out that in the horizontal direction, we would might like to clump the points into groups of four. And if you do that, in order to update each point, you can see from the diagram, you would only have to communicate with four of the neighbors. So that would minimize the communication instead of having to communicate with eight points. Of course, you have to consider making larger clumps and so on and balance the amount of parallelism you get with the amount of communication that you would need to have between the different tasks. But if you break it up this way, you get fairly small tasks, so there's lots of parallelism. It's very scalable and should lead to hopefully a good algorithm. Now the final thing in this example is to talk about the mapping. That is, we identified these tasks, we agglomerated them into the slightly larger tasks, and now we need to map them to processors. So it's a we can map one task per processor. We need to extend that. We might need to extend that if there is a cyclic mapping in some direction. If we have much larger number of tasks than processors, we may be able to do some sort of dynamic load balancing if it turns out that the amount of work in each task is unpredictable. So that's the end of that example about the atmospheric simulation. And now the final section in this talk is a section that talks a little bit just more generally about strategies for making for developing parallel computing software. So in this talk, we have discussed at a sort of a high level how to do parallel computing and just briefly about the kinds of software models that there are. And I don't know if you can tell from such a brief introduction, but in fact, doing these kinds of things such as load balancing, trying to balance the amount of parallelism that you get with versus the amount of communication is actually a very hard problem for many types of applications. So in fact, some of the software that's been developed to deal with these problems has not always been as mature as you might like, because the high-performance computing problem is really only a very small part of computing in general. So as Jeffrey puts it, you're solving computing's hardest problem with only 1% of the funding available for developing software. These are very complex problems. So in fact, one of the things that has happened in the hardware arena is that in the beginning of parallel computing, people built massively parallel computers with specialized processors. They developed special purpose processors in order to really increase the speed and lower the latency of the communication and so on. But it turned out that that was a very expensive proposition, and that eventually the processing power of ordinary commodity microprocessors got to be so high that essentially it's much more cost effective to use those microprocessors in your parallel computers as the computing nodes without making changes. So you're taking advantage of all the development that's gone into microprocessors in order to achieve better cost in the resulting parallel computer. So there are a group of people that are saying, why don't we do this, the same thing, with the software design? Instead of trying to develop special purpose, high performance languages and software, why don't we try to take advantage of commodity software in the same way that parallel architecture is taking advantage of commodity hardware? So what is commodity software? Well, commodity software, of course, is what comes from the most active software development domain, and at the moment, that's essentially the software that's being developed for the World Wide Web. That is this distributed computing information processing environment. So there are many kinds of software being developed for that, distributed object software such as CORBA and CON. The main language that's being used for all of this is the language Java. So there's a lot of development effort being poured into the language Java. Other technologies such as web link databases, HTML for documents, and so on. So since there has been so much effort put into developing this software, then in the middle it says, in quotes, just add high performance to this existing distributed computing software, and we will have high performance software. Of course, the reason the just is in quotes is because that might not be so easy, but this is something that's in process. The other way to leverage commodity software would be to start with special purpose, high performance computing languages and trying to use these distributed components wherever possible. So the idea of the amount of effort going into high performance computing versus the amount of software versus the amount going into commodity software is represented in this pyramid. The pyramid represents the amount of computing power and the amount of people using various kinds of computers. And at the top, We have high-performance computers, special-purpose supercomputers, and at the bottom, we have widely used technologies, the personal computers, the web, what people do on their desktops. And of course, at the bottom, there are millions of users, and at the top, there are not that many users. So it's natural for manufacturers to pour more development dollars into the bottom than into the top, because they can sell more software. So the idea is to try to have a bottom-up approach that leverages software developed for the web and for PCs and build it into software that can be used for high-performance computing. So that's one of the goals of the future development of high-performance computing software. In particular, there's a committee, a group of people in which MPAC participates, and in particular Jeffrey Fox, which is interested in looking at the language Java to be used in high-performance computing. That is, at the bottom of the pyramid, we have Java as it is currently used on the Internet for web-based computing and distributed computing. Excuse me. And at the top, we want to grow Java into a language that can be used for massively parallel computing. Excuse me. So that leads us to think about the three roles of the language Java as it might be used in scientific computing. First of all, one of the roles that it could now currently play because of its use as a language for in Java applets for visualization is to use it for visualization of data, scientific visualization, and the user interface. Then in the middle, we might already use Java for metacomputing because Java is good at distributed computing across the web, and that's essentially what we need for metacomputing. So that could be the software for that could be further developed. Then at the bottom, we might think about the role of Java, finally, for the high-performance part of the computing. That is, could Java be used as a language on a specialized massively parallel processor in order to do the parallel computing on that kind of hardware? So already we talked about kinds of languages that could be used for massively parallel processing, namely the data parallel languages such as HPF and the message passing languages such as MPI, and the proposal is to try to make Java into that kind of a language too. So why do people think that this might be a good thing? And one of the reasons is that Java has several good design features that enable you to add additional libraries, they're called classes or packages, to cover additional things. Right now there are libraries being developed to cover commerce, multimedia, and so on. People are working on math libraries. This effort is reported on the URL you see there in the middle of the screen at line 5 at the NIST organization under the Java Numerics group. And as Java is such, has available for it training, good resources, it's getting program development environments. So that's the kind of software development that people would like to leverage off of in commodity software. But does Java have the kind of operations that we would need in order to do parallel operations? Before I answer that question, let me just say for a moment that the group that is working on developing Java for high-performance computing is calling this effort Java Grande. It's hard to find a name for things anymore that doesn't get misunderstood by someone, but Java Grande is the name that's been picked. So it's to use Java for high-performance network computing, scientific computing, parallel and distributed computing, data-intensive computing, all of the things that make up high-performance computing for scientific applications. So Java does have some hooks to enable it to express parallelism. It already has excellent network classes, so it can do the message passing. So Java plus message passing is actually easier somewhat in Java than in Fortran or C. Coarse-grained parallelism is very natural in Java. What is not natural in Java is the data parallel features doing entire arrays. That would have to be built in. Java does have built-in threads so that you can run more than one process at a time. So you can think about breaking up into tasks that can be run in parallel. That would be easy to express in Java. But the parallel threads actually have a shared memory model of parallel computing. And so it would have to be a slightly different. So what was natural in, oh, and by the way, I do see the questions in the chat, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So what is natural in Java is that you would have, you could have some number of threads on a computer doing parallel tasks, but they would have to be using a shared memory model, or they wouldn't have to, but that would be the natural thing. But you could have them on various processors. In between the processors, you could use the message passing paradigm to communicate in between the processes. Okay, so the questions are about Java is much slower than C or C++. Can it really provide high-performance computing? There was a comment that that it's interpreted, and that's part of it, that there has been some effort into making just-in-time compilers. They are currently available, and you may have that. I think you may have that on your browser, where the language is only partially interpreted. It's interpreted the first time. If you have some sort of loop, then it saves the compiled code, and additional times it runs the code, it uses compiled code. But there are other issues about Java being slow as a high-performance language. And that is one of the crucial things that Java doesn't do yet. So there are various issues about making Java just do, you know, fast floating point and fast operation. How would you optimize the compilers? These are all part of the issues that have to be looked into. So there is a set of links showing here, a copy of a web page that we have at MPAC, Java for CSE. And part of it includes things from the Java Grande Forum, other links in which people discuss the issues about making Java into a high-performance language. That NIST link is here down in the middle level, and they have a particular list about some of the issues. There's also the issue about clicked on the wrong thing. Okay. About the fact that Java doesn't have complex types built in, and people are working on classes. There are a whole bunch of issues about how to provide complex arithmetic in Java. Well, the next slide isn't loading, but it's the last slide of the talk. So I will just talk about it. Let me try one more thing. No. Up, oh, here it comes. It just took a while. I don't know how long it will take for you. So the last slide is sort of, so what is the plan? What is the state of the art for these various kinds of that's not the last slide. That's the index. Well, I don't know what happened. Let me stop clicking things. So sort of the bottom line about these languages is what do we recommend that people use? Some languages are better for some things than others. And basically in this course, we made the decision that we would emphasize the programming in MPI, the message passing interface, with C primarily. And one reason was that we don't feel that the compilers for the data parallel languages like HPF are necessarily going to get the development that's going to really lead them into being really the most used languages in high-performance computing. So this is kind of a judgment call on Jeffrey Fox's part in feeling that MPI probably is going to be more used in the future and should be the language that we have you use in this course. So the remarks that we made just about Java are relevant here too, which is that we can use Java now for visualization, for user interfaces, and for distributed computing, but Java is not ready yet for doing the scientific computing part of the problem. So that concludes the section that I was going to do to finish up the introductory talk. And now I have some other topics for today. But let me just say that in the lecture sequence, the next thing is going to be talking about, in more detail, about a scientific problem, namely solving a partial differential equation, Laplace's equation, and what are the using it to illustrate the parallel computing issues and really getting into some details of parallel algorithms. So that will be on Tuesday. Jeffrey Fox will be here. And then on Thursday, we'll start talking about MPI and use it to start programming some of the parallel algorithms. Now for the rest of today, I wanted to do more about getting you started on doing homework. We still have the problem that we haven't been able to register everybody and find out background information, but my understanding from our preliminary survey is that not everyone has prepared web pages using HTML. So some of you probably have and some of you probably haven't. So I'm going to open a different tool here called the Shared Browser. And the Tango Shared Browser is just like a web browser. It's Netscape. You should get up a window that looks just like Netscape. But the difference is that it's shared via Tango, and I am what's known in this architecture as the master, or the teacher, let's call it. And when I click on links, then your version of the shared browser will show the page of those links. So it's similar to the way WebWisdom works, except that it's more like a browser, and actually you can click on links and get individual action. None of us will see what links you click on, but every time I click on a link, you will all see it. So anyway, I have to click on the first link so that you see it. And let me bring up the class web page, which I gave you the URL for before. And I'm going to look at the assignment page. I click on the link for the assignment page. So in the right-hand frame, you should be getting up the assignment page. It's very simple. It has one assignment called assignment 0. So assignment 0, I'm calling it assignment 0 because it's essentially preparation for doing your homework by creating a web page or a set of web pages. We'll call the class your class web page as opposed to the class web page, which is this central one, in which you can have a place where you post your homework assignments. So you need to be able to make web pages so you can post your homework assignments. Now, making web pages is really pretty easy, and I'm going to show you some examples here that should enable you to get started. So instead of clicking on this link, I'm going to type it in directly. So that it fills the whole screen instead of just the frame. So here is an example, just really brief, of what you might have for a student's web page. And actually, it doesn't really, to me, have a pleasing appearance, even though I made it. But I wanted to illustrate a number of things, like doing large text for headlines, centering things, putting up an image. I just grabbed a leaf because it was something I had lying around from before, not because it was particularly meaningful for this course. Then the important thing is that you should have a link to a page where you keep your homework assignments. You might have other links. I put up something called a link to personal information, and you should have a way to contact yourself. So you might have a link that shows an email address. So let me click on the link for homework assignments. And on this page, you would have a list which eventually will have all of your homework assignments, so that when we come and grade them, we can just come here and click on those links. So right now, those links don't do anything. So what I'm going to do is to just, if you haven't done HTML before, show you the HTML that makes this page as an example of how to make web pages. So the thing is, in order to get this page to look the way it is, HTML is a language that has tags, and the tags essentially give commands to the browser that says how to format the text and the images and the links that are going to appear here. So if I have prepared a file that just displays the HTML that made that page. And my other criteria, and one reason this page is plain, is that I wanted to keep the number of tags pretty small. So notice that the first thing in this file is a comment. The question is, where should we put these pages? Well, eventually you will put these pages on the class web server, but right now you don't have access to that. So to get started writing your pages, you will just do it locally on your PC. And you can view them with the browser to see if they're what you want. And then next week we'll give you directions about where to put the pages so that they are on the official sort of class homework list. So the first line in this file is a comment. You have to have that less than sign, exclamation, dash, dash. Then you can put anything, and you follow it with dash, dash, greater than sign. So the less than and the greater than signs have a more general role as being the symbols which always surround what's called a tag in this tag formatting language. So notice that, so there are lots of things in here that have less than and greater than signs around them, and they're all tags. So essentially everything that you do to tell the browser how to format the web page is done by giving these tags. Now the tags normally come in pairs. Notice that the first tag here is called HTML, and it's inside the less than and greater than. And if you look down at the bottom of this page, if your window is big enough, or you can scroll down if it's not, notice that there's a tag called slash HTML. So tags often come in pairs, and the start of the HTML tag is the one at the top, and the ending of the end HTML tag is at the bottom with the slash. So the end tags always have slash in front of them. Now, not all tags come in pairs, but many of them do. So this particular tag just has the meaning that everything in between here should be HTML. Now the next is that in your HTML file, it's separated into two parts. The first part is short and is called the head, And there is a head tag up there, and then if you look down a few lines, you can see the slash head tag that's at the end of that. Everything within the head tag doesn't actually appear on the browser window. It doesn't appear. And so you put things in here like definitions. Notice that in here is a title tag that says Jane Doe's homepage. And this doesn't appear on the web page in the browser window, but it is what the name that the browser calls this window. It appears on the title bar. If you make a bookmark, it appears there. So when you think of what kind of title to put on a web page, think of what, if somebody were to bookmark this page, what would you want to put to show up on the bookmarks? So the other section that occurs is the body section, and that's the main part that appears in the web browser window. So notice that there's a body tag, and then down at the bottom is a slash body tag. It's the end of the, right before the end of the HTML. Now also notice that the body tag that begins this body section has some other stuff before the end of the tag. It has something called BG color equals some quoted string. And this is typical. There are many tags that have additional information that occurs in the tags. And these are actually called attributes. So this BG color attribute stands for background color. And what I've put in that quoted string with the number sign followed by six Fs is the hexadecimal representation of the RGB color for white. Now, I'm not going to have time to get into colors. It's one of the things that is in the, I'm going to give you a set of links that if you want to go and design colors and do other things, you can go look up information. This is just going to be, you know, quick overview. So the first thing that's actually within the body is this tag called H1. H1 stands for headline. And there's a, notice that there's a slash H1 at the end of the line, homepage of Jane Doe. And that's what made that large typed version of the words, homepage of Jane Doe, appear at the top of the file. Now, the HTML just occurs on the page in the order that the tags occur in this file here. So after that, the next text that occurred was, welcome to my homepage. And the way that was put up was, first there's the center tag, and that's why that was centered. Then there's the text, welcome to my homepage. Then there's a tag called BR. Now, BR doesn't have a slash BR. It stands for break. It's what puts the next thing on a new line. The next thing was, if you remember the page, was the leaf. And the leaf was an image, and the way I included it on the page, the leaf occurs and was in a file called leaf.gif in the same directory as this HTML file. And so I included it by giving this image source tag. So this is the format of the image source tag. In the quotes, you put the name of the file that has the image. These width and height attributes are optional, but it helps the browser to load faster if it knows how big you want the image to appear. And that you can use those width and height to scale the image as well. So that's centered as well because we're still within the scope of the center tag. And then we have the slash center tag, so now centering is over, and the stuff that follows this won't be centered necessarily. So the next thing is a P tag. That stands for paragraph. It not only gives a new line, but it gives an extra blank line, so it creates more of a space. Then there's a tag called HR, which, let's see, stands for horizontal rule. And if you look at, we'll go back and look at that page. I don't know if you noticed, there was a line that stretched across the page, and that was the horizontal rule. Then there's another P tag to make a space. And then we had the link to the what looked like a link that had the words homework assignments for CPS 615. And that was produced by this next tag. Notice that it's the main part of the tag is called A. And A stands for anchor. It's another word for link. So think of this as a tag that makes a link. You say A space, you say href equals, and then in quotes, you put the URL of where you want the link to go to. And in general, you can put an arbitrary URL, but I just wanted it to go to a file in the same directory, so I put homework.html as the name of the file that will be loaded from the same directory. Now I put the greater than sign to close that tag. What comes next is the text that will label the link. That's homework assignments for CPS 615. And then I put slash A to be the end of the anchor tag, and that finishes the link. So I have more paragraphs, another link, another HR tag. Down at the bottom, there is a tag called address, which actually essentially produces italics. There are various things like I for italics, B for bold. And at the bottom, it says, please send question or comments to. And now I have a special form of a tag in which, instead of a regular URL, I put a URL that starts with mail to, colon, slash, slash, and then you give an email address. The label of this link is Jane's fictitious email address, because this isn't, so I don't want people to actually mail to this because it doesn't exist. But if you click on this link, the browser will bring up a mail form and in which you can send email to this address. And then I have the end of the anchor tag, the end of the address, and that was the end of the first page. So let me go back, and you can look again at how this turned out. So there was the big headline, the centered text, the centered image, the leaf, the horizontal rule, the two links, another horizontal rule, and then this italic line that has a link to an email address. So are there any questions about that so far? This has got to be the quickest HTML tutorial in history. So the next thing I want to show you is just the homework page. It has another kind of tag that I haven't shown you yet, which is how do you get those assignment things in order like that with the bullets, and that's called a list. And I'm going to now bring up the HTML that produced that page, just so you can see those list tags. Notice again, my first line is this comment that has the name of the file, homework.html. then I have HTML and head and title tags as before. My text editor sometimes puts in comments about when I changed files. So that's that comment after the title. But anyway, in the body, this headline, homework assignments for CPS 615, is smaller than the other one. It's H2, and you have numbers H1, H2, H3 is about as small as people go, because it's about the size of the regular text, only bold. But then the thing that I wanted to show you there is to start with the UL tag. That's an unordered list. And if you put an unordered list, you get a list of things that have bullets in front. You can also use OL, which is ordered, and it would number the items in the list. So for each item, I put LI in front of the item, and then I put the item that I want to appear in the list. And it can be text. It can be. It could even be an image. In this case, it's a link. Each item is a link. Or it could be a mixture of links and text. It could be more than one line. You can put there whatever you want after the LI. So I'm assuming that there will be pages called assignment1.html in the future in which I'm going to put my homework assignment corresponding to assignment 1. Okay, are there any questions about that? So if you like, you can take these simple pages and use them to make your class web pages. So your assignment is to make some class pages, web pages. You should have a main page. You should have a place where you can keep your assignments. If you want to have other information, you can. Here's a file. I started a file that just talked about who I am, what I'm interested in. Maybe I might have some interesting links of things that I think people might like to look at on the web and so on. I'm sure you've seen lots of people's web pages and you know the kind of things that they can do. But let me just show you, if I still have it on my list here, some examples from earlier classes, just in case you're interested. So this is from the spring class. They had a different topic. They were doing programming for the web and Java and stuff like that. But we'll eventually make a page in which your home pages appear. So these were the people in the class, and each time you click on one of these, you see one of the students' pages. If we click on the first one, Angela had a fairly plain page, but it did the job. She put in, I think we asked people to put in some text about what they're studying and why they wanted to take this course. But she has here her homework page. And here are all the assignments that they did for that course listed. And if you click on each one, you'll see the work that she did. So this is the kind of thing that we want to end up with you. She had a resume page, so that's up to you whether you want to have that. Or you can have, some people got fancier. Just depends on your personal taste. Let's see, who did something? Here's Mitch's page. So I hope I'm not embarrassing any of these students by showing their pages. But these are undergraduates, so I don't know if you know them. So here's Mitch's page. It's kind of actually kind of hard to read his homework page, but it's down there because it's blue text on a black background. so he just did some fancier appearing things, and you're welcome to do that. In fact, you might want to know, when you look at other people's web pages, you might get ideas about what you wanted to do for your page. And the thing that you can always do, and why don't you try that in the browser? I won't do it for you. Go up to the View item on the menu bar, pull it down, and click on Page Source. So if you view Page Source, you should get up a window that has the HTML that's got this in it. Is that working? Excuse me. Did that work okay? Okay, great. I should go back to the original page here, your homework page. Oh. I have to click on assignments, to click on assignment zero. And the other thing is that I gave another link down at the bottom here, which you can, where we've collected some materials about HTML. So if you want to try things out, if you have questions about stuff that you want to do, you can go here And there, you can look at examples. There are examples of how to do tables and frames, the HTML to do some of these other fancier things, so that you can come and look things up here. There are references to other people's tutorials. Okay, so I would like you all to work on preparing these pages over the coming week. I'm not entirely sure whether I'll make an additional assignment on Tuesday or Thursday, but one of those days will get you started on some other things. And then we'll start programming soon after that. So I think that now I want to, I hope I've left enough time that I really want everybody to sign in to this form in which you register for an account and get into the student record system so that you can see your grades later. So far it hasn't worked on any of the PCs, but our testing seems to indicate it works on the SGI, which is called MOSIS, in your lab. So is Professor Mitra there? Perhaps he or Mike could organize having people come up to MOSIS get a browser page, go to the class web page, go to the student link, and try to do this thing with the certificates and get through to that page. Now, after the first person has got through the certificates, let me know if you get that error. And if you do get the error, go ahead and click on the link again where it says I forget what it says at the moment, but anyway, click on the link again. Try to get through the page where you select the class. I don't think the video in the lab is working anymore, Mike. I haven't seen anybody move for a good 20 minutes. Oh, good. Well, am I still moving? Okay, so click on the link again. Well, you're only supposed to do this on the SGI, on MOSIS. Well, I mean, you can do it on the PC, but as far as we know, you still get that error. Trying it on the SGI. Who's on MOSIS? Oh, okay, good. So, Professor Mitra, are you getting that same error? Okay, great. So you get to the page that has pink on it, you select the class JSU fall 98, you get up a green page, scroll down to the bottom where it says New Students Register. I can't see who just wrote. But whoever's on Moses should go through to the green page, click on Enter here, and then you get up a page that has you type your name and some other information. There are some survey questions down at the bottom. So I need to get everybody to fill out that page. Now, one of the things you have to fill out right after your name is it asks you to make up an access name and a password. So this is the name and password that you're going to type in every time you go to check your grades, assuming that we get this to work. And it's supposed to be a secure system. That's why you need a name and a password. I suggest you make this different from your regular account on wherever you have your account, like Stallion. Different name and password. Shen Yu, are you on Moses? That's the SGI at the front of the room. Everybody has to take a turn at the SGI to do this. Great, thank you. I'm glad it's working, because if this didn't work, I was going to have you send me the information by email, and then I was going to have to type it all in myself, retype it. So this is good, because when you type it in, it goes directly into the database. And the password is being sent encrypted, so there shouldn't be any security problem. Nobody should be able to steal your name and password. So the first thing I'm going to do is use this information that you've typed in to create your accounts and your directories to submit your homework. And then after that, you will use this same name and password to get access to your grades after we've graded your homework. And again, it will be secure transmission. So the personal access code is something that you make up. Please make it something you can remember. It's like your username on a Unix system, only probably you should make it something different. Well, I guess that doesn't really matter as long as the password is different. Yes, you can select both the username and the password. Later you can change the password, but you can't change the username. So pick something that you can remember. Oh, the personal access code. Wait a minute. Let me just check that out, just a minute. Well, what is the first field it asks you after the After your name, your first name, last name, and so on. I'm just, mine's real slow here, so. Well, there's two parts. The personal access code is like a username, and then you also make up a password. So both of these are things that you make up. I had to check and make sure what they were called. Okay? So the personal access code could be something like your name, but the password should be something that people can't guess. And you're probably familiar with making up passwords.